This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello and welcome to the Anchoring Truths podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. Today, I'm ecstatic to have on our podcast a returning guest and someone I consider a very close friend, Josh Hammer. Josh is a 2021 James Wilson Fellow alumnus, as well as the contributing editor at Anchoring Truths. Besides those two connections to the Institute, Josh is the Newsweek Senior Editor-at-Large, host of The Josh Hammer Show, a syndicatum columnist, and a research fellow with the Edmund Burke Foundation. He previously worked at Kirkland & Ellis and First Liberty Institute. He clerked for Judge James Ho of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He's also been a John Marshall Fellow with the Claremont Institute. He took his J.D. from the University of Chicago Law School and earned his undergrad degree from Duke University. So Josh is on our show today to discuss a recently published set of remarks that he delivered at a 2022 conference titled Common Good Constitutionalism, after the book that Professor Adrian Vermeule wrote. Josh offered these remarks as part of a fantastic, really an all-star cast of contributors at the conference, and the title of his remarks was Common Good Constitutionalism and Common Good Originalism, a Convergence. So Josh, with his remarks, gives an update on the theory of interpretation that he's titled Common Good Constitutionalism. It's a subject we've taken up on this podcast before. But he also gives an account on our show of just how much overlap there is between his approach, kind of the natural law jurisprudence approach that we have at the Institute, and Professor Vermeule's approach. I think you'll find the next 45 minutes fascinating, and we hope you enjoy the program. Josh, it is a pleasure to have you back on the Anchoring Truths podcast. For our listeners, Josh is one of the contributing editors at Anchoring Truths, and I can't think of any of our alumni that are as central to our work at the James Wilson Institute than Josh. He is not only a public figure that you might be aware of through his writings and his public speaking, but he is somebody that has taken it on himself to be a public scholar as well. And that's the reason why we're having him on our podcast today, to talk about his latest piece of scholarship. So Josh, welcome.
Garrett, it's great to be with you, my friend. You know, I last saw you at our wedding, so good to have more FaceTime than I had at the actual wedding. But look, you know, real quick, I'll say that I get asked a lot when I do Federal Society talks, when I give legal talks. They say, oh, are you a professor? Or are you doing this or that in legal academia? I say, no, I just occasionally play one. So I'm happy to play one for purposes of our colloquy today.
Fantastic. Mark Mateo is one of our interns this semester at the Institute. Mark and I are delighted to have digested your remarks from the 2022 conference on Adrian Vermeule's Common Good Constitutionalism. And so, Mark, why don't you get us started?
Yeah, you know, as you said, thanks, Josh, for being on the podcast with us. You know, it's been a couple of years, I think, since you've been thinking about this Common Good Originalism. I mean, did you ever expect it, I think, to catch on in the way that it did? Because it's become at least fairly central in, you know, discussions about judicial interpretation and on the right. So I'm curious.
You know, the short answer is no. I'm always pleasantly surprised when I hear that common good originalism is being discussed as frequently as it is. So, you know, for example, I just mentioned that I do a number of Federal Society events on this particular topic. And I was up in Boston about a month ago or so, and I was talking at Boston College, at BC College of Law. And before my FedSoc talk, I actually sat in for the final hour of a seminar on conservative legal thought and jurisprudence. And they just happened to be talking about my essay that day. So I sat in on the seminar and kind of guest lectured about it and asked and answered student questions and whatnot there. And then I saw a similar, very kind comment from Andrew Walker, the Ethics and Public Policy Center fellow and Christian scholar, talking about how he was reviewing it with his theology students or divinity students. And I'm always pleasantly surprised when something like this happens. I mean, to kind of like rewind the clock a little bit here, look, you have to go back to the year 2020, which is when all of this momentum really started. Adrian Vermeule writes his Common Good Constitutionalism, I think it was titled Beyond Originalism. He writes that initial essay at the Atlantic magazine right after the COVID lockdowns. It was in late March 2020. I had seen Adrian a few weeks prior to that at Harvard Law School. I was giving a FedSoc talk that day on Stare Decisis, totally unrelated topic. Got coffee with Adrian at the Commander Sheridan Hotel afterwards, and he teased me this forthcoming article. And I remember reading it, and times I was like really nodding along, and at times I was like, I'm not entirely sure I would agree with that. But I knew that there was some sweet spot. There was some sweet spot between exactly what Adrian was saying and the state of the originalism, Inc., originalism establishment status quo, which at that time, many of us were deeply worried about what might happen with Justice Gorsuch in the Bostock case. There was just a general sense that originalism was not delivering. But I want to be very careful here. I'm not talking here strictly from a consequentialist results-oriented perspective. I'm saying it was not delivering insofar as the term originalism had taken on a meaning and life of its own that was so unmoored from what it should be, what it was once upon a time, and what it should be. So I knew that there was some sweet spot, and I wrote that first Common Good Originalism essay as part of the Claremont Institute's American Mind Symposium. I believe Hadley also contributed to that. Actually, Gary, you both did. You guys both contributed to that same symposium. And I did get immediately positive feedback, and I sensed that I was touching a nerve there. I did get a lot of good feedback from people, but you know, here we are. It's been, almost 4 years since that initial contribution of the American Mind, and I'm personally very pleasantly surprised at the shelf life that it has gotten.
Well, I think part of the interest in this debate comes from that expectation that originalism needs to have something more than kind of a self-justification, right? We talk about how natural law provides the framework for understanding how there can be, you know, a multiplicity of, you know, axioms that are true of necessity. But just like, you know, we can say like consent doesn't provide the ground of its own justification, like originalism needs something more. And I think that's really what we were trying to drill down on. And because, you know, Adrian was seeking sort of the same kind of philosophic inquiry. Of course, he was thinking that originalism could not be saved, whereas I think you and I are in broad agreement that, you know, either, you know, the term originalism or the academic and judicial practice of originalism, you know, can still be redeemed. Nevertheless, we were kind of, you know, pursuing a similar project. Have you seen even, you know, at the conference back in 2022 and since, have you seen this abiding interest in conservative jurisprudence at a crossroads still being the topic of discussion? Or are you perhaps seeing maybe follow-on discussions where maybe we now know that indeed there is a problem, and now the question is what to do about it?
Right. So there's a lot to unpack there, Garrett. I mean, you know, I do flash back to that conference at Harvard. So this was over Halloween weekend. It was in late October 2022. It took a little while for the actual written portion of that symposium to get out there. And there was a political reporter by the name of Ian Ward who wrote a deep dive piece on the conference at the time. And he actually wrote a very fair piece. He profiled Professor Vermeule, myself, Judge Jim Ho, who I, of course, clerked for and I'm still very close with. Mm-hmm. And he kind of just talked about the conference and kind of the jurisprudential wars on the right. And I say all that because that was a big piece that got a lot of eyeballs at the time, I think. And that came out. So the conference was late October. I think that came out in December 2022, if I remember correctly.
Yep,
there.
That's right.
And recall that the Dobbs case had come out then 6 months earlier in June 2022. So a lot of people thought, I think, Garrett, that these debates would just die with the Dobbs case, right? The more cynical amongst the commentariat, not amongst us, because, you know, you and I are ardent pro-lifers, but I think the more cynical among the commentariat perhaps would have thought that some people who were challenging originalism perhaps were even hoping for the other results in Dobbs simply to make these lingering debates more viable. I saw a lot of people accusing Vermeule of that with really no justification or no basis whatsoever. It's coming from a place of bad faith. But nonetheless, Dobbs delivers. That doesn't go all the way by any means. I mean, as you know, Josh Craddock and I have written on constitutional personhood. I know it's something that Hadley's passionate about as well. So certainly Dobbs is not the end of the road, but many of us, I think, did fear that Dobbs could be a premature end of these debates that frankly had just picked up in earnest with Vermeule's essay and my essay and whatnot just 2 years prior. And I'm pleased that really has not been the case, that conference in 2022, that Politico article, and you still see a lot of people writing and talking about it. Vermeule has taken on other subjects, but he still writes quite a bit about coming to constitutionalism. I personally, you know, in a personal capacity, I still get asked a lot to do Federal Society events on coming to originalism. Now, I get asked to talk about other topics too. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But hopefully the fact that the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy just published this new written symposium following up on the in-person symposium that was a year and a half ago-ish now, hopefully that will kind of propel this thing into the future as well. Because ultimately, the debates we're having, Garrett, aren't actually about Dobbs. They're not actually about Bostock. They're about the proper way to interpret a document and about fundamental questions of epistemology and truth. I mean, that's really ultimately what we're getting at here. So I think to tie those debates to a time, place, and manner to kind of, you know, crudely borrow the First Amendment jargon, I think we'll be doing a huge disservice to the broader debate.
What do you think is the primary crisis that Common Good originalism responds to?
I think that the primary crisis that I was trying to respond to, which I was kind of alluding to earlier, and it's not wholly dissimilar, I think, to really at all to the work of you and Hadley and the James Wilson Institute, is trying to remind people what originalism actually is supposed to be. And I think back to the Federalist paper from Hamilton, I believe it's Federalist 31. I know Hadley likes to cite it a lot, where it's his very first sentence. I don't have it memorized verbatim, but paraphrasing closely here, Hamilton says, you know, it is necessary, or it is obvious, that in all legal reasoning or moral reasoning, it is necessary to build upon certain pre-existing anchoring principles, anchoring truths, and so forth there. And that's kind of how we got the name of the publication, Anchoring Truths, right? It is exactly from that Hamilton quote there in Federalist 31. So I think the Common Good originalism is basically trying to do that, is trying to remind people, well, where is this actually coming from? I mean, you say that you are trying to interpret this thing according to the original public meaning. You say, perhaps, if you're channeling Scalia, that you are so wedded to the four corners and a narrow view of the page. But what actually is it that you are doing there when you're looking at the four corners of the page? And, you know, in my Common Good originalism standard stump speech, I've given this talk enough where I've developed something of a stump speech. You know, I like to talk a little bit about corpus linguistics as well. And to me, corpus linguistics is kind of the apotheosis of positivist originalism on steroids. And for the listeners who are not super familiar, corpus linguistics is a software program. It's an analytical tool that is probably primarily associated with former Utah Supreme Court Justice Tom Lee, who is probably the biggest proponent of it. There are certainly others. And I do not in any way say this whatsoever to besmirch or denigrate Justice Lee, who is a great man and a brilliant man for that matter. But I do disagree with his use of corpus linguistics. And corpus linguistics is basically where, let's say you're trying to discern the meaning of a word or a clause or a provision in a certain contract or treaty, constitution, statute, doesn't really matter. So you'll plug into the input into the input elements into the analytical software program. You'll say, well, what is the term? What is the year? And like, what is the location? I'm talking Philadelphia, London, Paris, whatever. And then the algorithm will algorithmically rank the dictionaries based on the prevalence of use at the time and spit out to you what the actual answer is. So, I mean, that is basically, I'm not saying that if Scalia necessarily endorsed corpus linguistics towards the end of his life, but that is that mentality taken to its logical conclusion, right? And I guess fundamentally, Garrett, just thinking about this, that's not law. That ceases to be law. Why do you have to go to law school? Why do you have to be learned in what the classics, Cicero and people like that, called law? You don't. You literally are just lazily outsourcing the duties, what Ralph Lerner referred to as Republican schoolmasters. You're lazily outsourcing that to a computer program. And I admittedly, that's kind of the whole positivist enterprise taken to its logical conclusion. Not every kind of standard Scalia or Gorsuch opinion is written along those lines. It would be disingenuous of me to say that. But that is the broader crisis that I'm trying to refer to there. And again, trying to find a sweet spot between that and what Adrian proposes there. Like you, I don't know that it's worth bailing on the nomenclature or the phraseology of originalism. I think the broader label has done a lot more good than harm, certainly, for sure, over the past 4+ decades since it first entered the legal and broader political lexicon. I think it's done a lot of good. I mean, the current court compared to what they were doing pre-1982, I think is leaps and bounds better, but that doesn't mean that it's perfect either.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And it just brings to mind when we are asking our friends to join us, we're not asking them to abandon the originalist project, but rather to remember who the original originalists were, the American founders, their motions of mind, and that just like you brought up in your discussion of corpus linguistics, the American founders, they had access to their Blackstone, they had access to Montesquieu, to Cicero. These were not men who required the kind of precision that a lexicographer today might require. That doesn't mean that the kind of resources that corpus linguistics, the kind of mass databases that corpus linguistics draws upon can't be second order evidentiary, useful for second order evidentiary findings. But when you put the cart before the horse, or when you ask the findings of your corpus linguistics analysis to replace the jurisprudential reasoning that is at the heart of any kind of determination by a judge, what you've done, therefore, is you've, I think, committed a fatal conceit. And the fatal conceit is that one may understand history as the proper guide for a judge, as opposed to a judge understanding history and then making a determination.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I'm happy you use the term fatal conceit. Somewhat ironically, I mean, that's kind of a Hayekian concept, but there's actually kind of this fatal conceit, frankly, when it comes to the positivist originalist enterprise taken to its logical conclusion. I mean, the fatal conceit of the corpus linguistics acolytes is that you are going to know the one true correct answer by virtue of a computer program. Even absent corpus linguistics, the fatal conceit would be that standard tools of statutory construction and statutory interpretation will lead you to the one true and correct answer. But I actually, in my original long form Common Good Originalism essay, the one that went up at the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy in summer of 2021, that was the first time that I really fleshed it out from its kind of bare bones predecessor a little over a year prior to that. I use the concept of epistemological humility a lot. I think that epistemological humility is actually something that many originalist theorists tend to be lacking. And I think that is a kind of bread and butter trait that conservatives and frankly just all good statesmen and jurists and philosophers in general ought to have a little more epistemological humility. So then my question, to kind of again borrow the nomenclature and the phraseology of the originalist academy, is well, what do you do? What do you do if you're exercising humility and you're not entirely sure and you're within what originalist scholars refer to as the construction zone? Well, what actually is it that you're going to do? And no one exactly knows what the answer is. I'm not sure that there is one capital A answer, but you should have an answer for that. You should be able to answer that question, right? And one key point that I like to make here as well is, a lot of kind of the great defenders of Scalia-style originalism like to think that they are truly value neutral, right? So for example, when this debate was getting going back in 2021, right before my first JLPP essay was published that summer, I debated this twice against Ed Wheel, and once at the Heritage Foundation's Judicial Clerkship Academy. That debate was in person in DC. And then I debated it once over him over Zoom in a Federal Society event. And, both times I asked Ed the same question, which was, well, what do you do when you're in the construction zone? What do you do where a reasonably humble interpreter gets you to a point where there are multiple plausible or at least non-frivolous possible constructions? And his answer was to defer to legislative majorities. And this is, I think, his kind of attempt to say that it's value neutral. But it's not value neutral because the implicit value judgment that an interpreter is making there is in favor of lowercase d democracy. That is the value judgment, which, oh, by the way, happens to be the same value judgment that Stephen Douglas made time and time again against Abraham Lincoln in 1858 up and down the entire prairie state, the state of Illinois. The reason, of course, that we remember Lincoln and not Douglas is that Lincoln came over the top of Douglas and said that, no, there actually are some much more important things than majoritarianism run amok, than lowercase d democracy, popular sovereignty, to use Douglas's term there. So, again, all of those concepts are really what I'm trying to get at. Whether I've done it perfectly, I think, is in the eye of the beholder. But at a bare minimum, Garrett, I've been very happy to help get this broader conversation started.
I for one, think you did a fine job of, at least starting that conversation with regard to the differences between you and, say, where the positivist originalist might lie. On the other wing lies, I think, Vermeule and sort of the Common Good Constitutionalist Project. Maybe could you more explain a little more sort of where you talk about the sweet spot, and you are trying to carve the sweet spot out between the two. What do you think is like the space between sort of your Common Good Originalist Project and Vermeule's? And maybe as a follow-up, I think Vermeule has this sort of reliance on the classical legal tradition. One might worry, say that you're not maybe like you could be just departing sort of these ideals set out at the founding for some sort of moral reasoning that goes that route. So I guess what restrains you from or your project from, I guess, departing the ideal set of the founding, I think, for the broader classical legal tradition, as Vermeule might.
So I think that there are two key distinctions between Adrian's thesis and mine, and I think that these distinctions have grown narrower over the past few years, which is kind of what prompted my remarks at the October 2022 JLPP symposium, which again was in the written form in the JLPP issue that just came out a few months ago. And the first difference between Adrian and I, which is what you're getting at here, is that Adrian's proposal is very, very heavily rooted in the Roman law. That's basically his thesis. Is that you could draw a fairly straight line from the Roman law to the American system of law. I guess implicit in that argument would be an argument that the English common law was itself very heavily reliant, perhaps majority reliant, on the Roman law itself. And look, I'm not going to sit here and denigrate the Roman law or something. The great Richard Epstein, who I had for two classes at the University of Chicago Law School, famously teaches Roman law virtually every year. I didn't actually have him for Roman law. I had him for land use and criminal procedure. I think it was his first time ever teaching criminal procedure. But in any event, I'm not going to sit here and denigrate the Roman law to you, but I do have a slightly different view of the history, which is I'm coming from something of a more Anglophilic perspective, as someone who tends to emphasize our common law inheritance a little more strongly. I think that Blackstone is maybe the single underappreciated source for the American founders. I'm genuinely not sure that there was any Englishman who was more influential upon the founding generation than Sir William Blackstone. And frankly, I don't think that he just gets the credit that he deserves, except in kind of erudite legal circles, the kind of folks who know this already. But his commentaries on the laws of England were absolutely indispensable reading, completely indispensable for the founding generation, for learned statesmen in subsequent American generations like Lincoln himself there. And, my reading of the common law, I, again, I'm not going to pretend that the Roman law tradition did not play a role, but my reading is that it was frankly just religion. It was like it was scripture, the Bible, and Christianity that above all was really what they were doing there. That is really above all what they were relying on. Yes, they had invocations to natural law. Yes, they were interested in the Roman law. Sometimes that guided them. But I take a more scripture-centric view of the development of the English common law. There are any number of examples of that. Just to give you kind of one parochial example, as the token Jew in the conversation, I'd love to point to the fact that there was a brilliant medieval common lawyer by the name of John Selden, who is often underappreciated. And he was not Jewish himself, but he was actually a Talmudic scholar. He knew much more about Talmud than the overwhelming majority of Jews living in his contemporary era. And he tried to incorporate many of those concepts actually into his common law judging, which is really, really quite fascinating. So in any event, that slightly separate emphasis and view of the actual intellectual history, I think, is definitely a difference that remains between myself and Adrian. The other difference that remains at this point, which is more practical for present purposes and more practical for actually interpreting the Constitution probably, is, again, I call myself an originalist still for a reason. He does not. And the reason for that is that I think I do take the original meaning a little more seriously. And as I phrase it in the JLPP essay, I'm operating at a more prudential level of abstraction. So the way that I kind of phrase it in the recent essay is, I think if you look at it as something of a sliding scale from the positivist originalist, from Will Bode, my own former two-time professor, just like Epstein, when you go from Will Bode and Steve Sachs at Harvard, and then to me in the middle, and then to Vermeule on the other extreme, you're basically going up a gradation of what the proper level of abstraction is, where the positivist originalist would take it at a very low level of abstraction. I'm trying to hit this sweet spot. We might call it the prudential sweet spot. Aristotle famously called prudence the queen of the virtues, right? And then Vermeule's taking it at a higher level of abstraction. In fact, so high that he eschews the label of originalism in the first place. That's probably why he eschews the label of originalism in the first place, because he's operating at that high of a level of abstraction. And to give you just a couple of examples, because I get asked this question a lot when I do these Fed Stock talks on this, is, Josh, you know, actually, and when it comes to cash out cases, how are you and Vermeule different? Well, we're similar in many ways on kind of a case outcome basis. We have a very similar view of free speech. We both would agree with Justice Alito's heroic dissent in Snyder versus Phelps, for example. We have a similar view of constitutional personhood over the 14th Amendment, things like that. But I'll point to just two quick examples to kind of demonstrate why, or at least how, in some cases, it probably cashes out differently. So one would be the Gonzalez versus Raich case. This is the homegrown marijuana case. Randy Barnett litigated all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Dude in California is growing marijuana in the backyard of his house for a marketplace of precisely one person, one household at most. You know, not only is there no interstate commerce, there is no intrastate commerce outside of his home. The question becomes, can the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, the statute passed under Richard Nixon's presidency, can that possibly reach this under Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause grounds? And, you know, what our libertarian friend Ilya Shapiro refers to as Justice Scalia's war on drugs loophole to his jurisprudence, Antonin Scalia, in a concurrence, says yes. But then Clarence Thomas, former Chief Justice Bill Rehnquist, and Sandra Day O'Connor all say no. So Vermeule agrees with Scalia. And I'm a war on drugs guy. I despise drugs. If I were a monarch, I would just disappear these things tomorrow by snapping my fingers. So I want to be able to get there, but I just can't. I just can't. I do not think that any reasonable or respectful view of the Commerce Clause can possibly reach activity of this nature. I mean, again, it's not even not intrastate. It's intra-household, right? So that I think would be one example. Vermeule has publicly said that he agrees with Scalia in the Raich case. Another just quick example would be the DC versus Heller case. So on the one hand, it actually kind of may strike you as a case where common good originalism could clearly lead you to the liberal dissenter's opinion that the Second Amendment is not an individual right, because over and over again in common good originalism, I place a strong emphasis on the importance of preambulatory language. And in the Second Amendment, you have a key preambulatory phrase, the right of a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. So some people might say, oh, wow, Josh, how do you not support the dissenters? And I let me be honest here. I actually think the common good originalism can definitely more plausibly justify the dissenting opinion than standard originalism. However, again, here, because I'm respecting the text at a respectful, reasonable view, I ultimately cannot get over the fact that the term right of the people is used 3-4 times in the Bill of Rights. It's right there. And it just cannot possibly mean something different in the Second Amendment that it means in the First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, and so forth. So again, Vermeule is a robust defendant of the dissenting view in the Heller case, but for other reasons, I would not be.
Ask you, Josh, you brought up reliance on the preamble. Of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind our listeners that the phrase "we the people" was first crafted by our namesake, James Wilson, and later, if James Madison was the father of the Constitution, James Wilson might very well have been the uncle of the Constitution, particularly for the Committee on detail on which he served. I remember you told me at one conference in response to your leaning on the preamble that Ed Whalen said, but Josh, isn't that just a form of positivism? And I wonder if maybe you've had some time to think on whether that was a sharp rejoinder, or if indeed this is just, you know, part and parcel of Common Good originalism, where you do need some kind of textual hook.
Well, I think, Garrett, that textual hook so first of all, I do take a strong view of the preamble, because I do take a strong view in general of the idea of ratio legis, as I phrase it in the paper. That's a Blackstonian concept. That's literally straight from Blackstone. He emphasized over and over again in his commentaries the importance of ratio legis, which translates as reason of the law. To me, ratio legis, reason of the law, is very similar to the Aristotelian concept of telos. I mean, they're not quite synonymous, but they're ultimately getting at the same concept, which is what is actually happening here. I mean, why are we doing this? What is the reason for this? And I do think that the conservative legal movement and the originalism establishment has kind of lost its way a little bit by moving so far away from anything remotely resembling purposivism. Now, I'm not proposing an outright purposivist form of jurisprudence. I think that would be incorrect. The movement decades ago did move away from original intent to original public meaning, but you know, certainly some element of intent, some element of why was this necessary in the first place, really, really ought to be necessary. The Bostock case, by the way, is a perfect example of that.
Right.
You know, I think any reliance whatsoever on what was the ratio legis, what was the telos of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, could not possibly get you to the majority opinion that Justice Gorsuch gave us. There's no way whatsoever, right? So I say all that because I do genuinely believe that the preamble is, or at least should be, important for that reason alone, that ratio legis and the notion of telos and teleology ought to make the preambulatory language important. But more broadly speaking, I think that it is kind of a hook again into this common law tradition that we inherited that I'm referring to here. Because if you look at what's actually said there in the preamble, general welfare, more perfect union, they're communitarian aims. I mean, they're common good oriented aims. And again, I say that because that is kind of a hook into the English common law, which, yes, they of course were passionate about individual rights, but it was a much more communitarian view of law and society than I think many kind of contemporary jurists, or many even contemporary self-identified legal conservatives, would otherwise be familiar with. And ultimately, of course, when you speak of the common good, it's very hard to kind of wholly divorce that from ultimate questions of theology and the fate of man and things like that, which, again, the common lawyers were frequently doing when they were issuing rulings. So to me, it's important on its own for teleological and ratio legis reasons, but it is also kind of just a good clue into this broader tradition, this common law and frankly just Bible and scripture rooted tradition that really was our true inheritance, that jurists like James Wilson, statesmen like Alexander Hamilton, certainly John Marshall, certainly Joseph Story, they understood this intuitively. You know, it's funny. Common good originalism to me is my label, but I didn't invent this. I mean, I think, Garrett, that the OG common good originalism opinion, you might say, and I think I said this way back in my first essay for the American Mind back in May of 2020. You know, I think it's McCulloch versus Maryland. I mean, that is common good originalism. That's John Marshall writing in 1818, 1819. I can't remember the exact year, but he's arriving at a common good originalist outcome against kind of idiosyncratic conceptions of individual liberty, whereby you would be quote unquote free from a national bank. And, you know, last I checked, even Clarence Thomas actually agrees with the correctness of McCulloch versus Maryland. So on a certain level, common good originalism, as I said in the original June 2021 GLPP essay, really is not just our future, I hope, but also very much our inheritance as well.
I think this is a great place to pick up, you know, when you're sort of invoking of a telos, at least the way that Aristotle understood it. You know, you referenced, I guess, these legal conservatives, and I think this idea, at least their hesitancy in invoking that term, is that, you know, you wonder if it makes at least the American project seem less compatible with liberal democracy than at least maybe one's intuition might suggest, insofar as, you know, America was I guess, the first country to, you know, form some sort of liberal democratic constitution without, you know, a prescripted end. Maybe you might disagree with your reliance on the, you know, preamble. But I'm curious, sort of, you know, on the one hand, you're, at least America is departing from the classical tradition of a telos. And on the other hand, you know, when we see the preamble, it relies on it. Or so I'm curious, like, do you see any one of the two either predominating at the time of the American founding, or more generally, I think, what do you think is the relationship of each to the other, sort of in understanding the constitutional debate?
So, sorry, can you clarify the two things that I understand the idea of telos of the American founding, but what is the other element you're talking here?
I think maybe this sort of rights oriented liberal democratic project, or maybe do you say that liberal democracy, you know, how do you understand it? Do you understand it as more, say, communitarian in principle? Or, you know, what is the purpose of rights? So what is this interplay, I think, that we're trying to find here, if that makes sense?
Yeah, look, the founders themselves disagreed on a lot of these subjects, famously, right? But I mean, going back to the 1790s, the Pacificus Helvidius debates and some of the great early republic debates continuing into the 1800s, you know, I mean, can we call America a liberal democracy at that time? Maybe. I mean, it'd be a stretch, honestly. Conservative democracy, probably. You know, is it really a liberal democracy at that time where, you know, women don't have the franchise? Obviously, we have the peculiar question, the great original sin of slavery that has not yet been resolved. But more to the point, you also have prosecutions for things like blasphemy, you know, in New York State up until 1808, the 18 teens, maybe in the 1820s or so. You have robust enforcement of the common law of defamation, something that continued all the way up until New York Times versus Sullivan in the 1960s. And, you know, lots of other examples as well there. So I'm not entirely sure how much of a true, quote unquote, liberal democracy America was back then. I mean, even from kind of a political economy perspective here, I mean, the idea that the American founders, you know, we're all kind of Adam Smith, you know, Hayek or Hayekian kind of, you know, free market laissez-faire absolutist. I mean, maybe. I mean, free market thought was really just developing back then. I mean, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations the same year as the Declaration. And you had the whole American system school of thought that was being led by Alexander Hamilton. He had his famous report, opinion on manufacturers, where he famously called for an industrial policy in 1791. I mean, I'm not saying that industrial policies is incompatible with liberal democracy, but I'm just saying that it was not kind of this liberal or libertarian utopia by any stretch of the imagination. Anyone who has done anything remotely resembling an authentic view of speech and religion at the time of the founding would certainly conclude that America was not a liberal paradise when it came to either of those things. I mean, to give just one other example, you know, official state level establishments of religion continued in New England well into the 19th century. You know, Massachusetts, Connecticut. I think Massachusetts had the Congregationalist Church, if I'm not mistaken, as its official church. Yeah. Exactly, 1833, if I'm not mistaken. So, I don't know that that's directly incompatible with liberal democracy, but it's not liberal democracy is not really necessarily the phrase that I would use either. So, you know, overall, I do think that the founders had a sense of purpose. They were famously divided as to where they were coming from. You had kind of the true Enlightenment radicals, the Jeffersons, the Paines. You had kind of the other end of the spectrum with John Jay and people like that there. But they overall had a plan, and you know, they really did kind of leave to future generations. I think the at times pragmatic and prudential necessities of trying to balance the question that you're getting at here, which is kind of how to balance rights with the common good. But they definitely had a more communitarian common good view of how to balance those things than many modern generations are comfortable with.
Yeah, I think to sort of place yourself in the era of the American founding was to from our modern vantage is really to place yourself in a it's like the old saying, like the past is a foreign country. That doesn't mean we can't recover it. But you really have to do a much more dedicated process to situate yourself in their world. And to what you were saying, Josh, even among the founders, there were profound disagreements. I'm thinking back to the disagreements between Justices Chase and Iredell in Calder versus Bull over the role of the judge in making explicit appeals to the natural law as the grounds for overturning a statute. I think that, that was a far more live debate in that era. And Iredell's position only became the consensus among the federal judiciary over time through historical practice and precedent, not because it was a more compelling argument at the time of the founding. In fact, if you read Wilson in Chisholm versus Georgia, and you read Marshall in I think several of his other opinions, you get the sense that there was not this assumption you were doing something that quote unquote, went beyond the text by making appeals to the natural law. Maybe this is where our project, your Common Good Originalism and Adrian Vermeule's Common Good Constitutionalism express some, profound agreement in that we are trying to restore that type of approach to judging, which again, would not have been foreign to the founders, but has only become more so today.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what we're trying to do. And look, I do think that over the past few years, Adrian's position, my position have gotten closer to each other. So, to give just one, I'll give one concrete example. I explained this in my recent GLPP contribution from the symposium. But, when Adrian first started writing on this with that Atlantic essay, it wasn't obvious to me that he even conceded the legitimacy of fixation thesis, the idea that words are fixed in any capacity. And, Bill Pryor, Chief Justice Bill Pryor of the 11th Circuit, issued a speech and then turned it into a law review article where he took pretty strong aim at Vermeule, a lesser strong aim perhaps at Hadley and myself. And Vermeule and his freaking co-author, Connor Casey, the young and precocious law professor at the University of Liverpool, they co-authored a response to Chief Judge Pryor's speech in the JLPP. And at some point in their essay, when the notion of fixation came up, they basically say, oh, yeah, of course we agree with fixation. I mean, how could you not? And I read that and I was kind of like, oh, OK, well, that's good to know. I mean, you know what it reminds me of, actually? It kind of reminds me of the Coach Kennedy case, where the court basically says, at some point, Lemon versus Kurtzman was overturned. Well, like, when exactly was it overturned? I mean, you didn't really tell us that. I mean, I'm happy to know that we're not considering a good law and it's going to get the red flag treatment in Westlaw. But I mean, you could have just explicitly said that, I mean, to help the layman out there. So anyway, I was happy to see Adrian concede that. He certainly has very much, I think, moved closer to my position with that concession. On the other hand, One of the things that really tripped me up at the beginning of these debates back in early 2020 was what our friend Christopher Green of Ole Miss Law School refers to as the oath argument, which is the argument that the oath clause that refers to this Constitution has to necessarily entail an originalist construction. And I've basically just done a 180 on that. I'm not really sure how else to explain it. I bought it at first. I just don't think I buy it anymore. I actually buy Vermeule and Jordan Perkins's arguments that militate in the other direction, that this argument really, that this Constitution should not be overread, that it literally just means like this Constitution, not like the Canadian or the Mexican Constitution, but like this Constitution. Like, there's no reason to read more into the text than we otherwise would. But here's what I will say, Garrett, on a more substantive note. Yes, Vermeule and I ultimately are getting at a similar point here, and an example that I give during the course of my Common Good Originalism stump speech is I talk about the Nuremberg trials there, and I always ask the law students, the Nazis who were tried for war crimes in Nuremberg, they basically all said the exact same thing when they were asked by prosecutors, why do you do this? How could you justify doing this? And they infamously all said, sir, I was just following orders. That's basically what they all said. And it's getting at this point that, okay, well, if simply following orders if simply following the black letter of the law is sufficient, then how do you necessarily know that they were wrong? But you obviously know that they were wrong. And what differentiates the American Constitution from the Soviet Constitution or the Nazi dictates, whatever they purported to call their system of quote unquote law, the difference is that ours is oriented towards substantively good and just ends, and theirs were not. In fact, they were oriented towards actually outright perpetuation of evil in this realm. And to me, the preamble, the declaration to an extent, but really the preamble is the most explicit paean to that, most explicit ode to what the just ends of governance are. I mean, there are seven ends enumerated there in the preamble. If you include the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity as two separate ends, I count seven by my count. Those are good and just ends. I mean, if I were concocting a constitution today in the year 2024, I probably could not do a better job than that. And it is the teleological legitimacy, frankly, of our Constitution that makes it respecting as a good and just and beautiful document in the first place. Therefore, when in the construction zone, that is what I choose to err on the side of.
Josh, switching gears a little bit here, towards the end of your JLPP article, you're making commentary on congregate constitutionalism and specifically its reliance on the administrative state. And sort of, at least you leave open the question of whether sort of a particular view of its legitimacy or morality is methodologically intrinsic or extrinsic to that project. But I'm curious, how concerned are you about the legitimacy or morality of the administrative state to what you're putting forth in Common Good Originalism?
Yeah, I did pose that question. I'm not entirely sure what exactly the answer is. I suspect that it's intrinsic, but that's really just me hazarding a guess, according to the common good constitutionalist mentality. To be perfectly candid with you, administrative state and administrative issues more generally are not my area of primary concern. In fact, I think that this hyper excessive focus on the administrative state has been indicative or symptomatic, you might say, of the entire originalist movement, of the entire legal conservative movement kind of going off the rails a little bit towards a more hyper-libertarian direction. Do I think that the administrative state overall is a good thing? No, I am not generally speaking a fan of Wilsonian progressivism. I am not generally a fan of this notion of top-down elites. I mean, we live in a time where elites of all stripes, of all parts and stripes, increasingly seem like they have no interest in doing what is best for the people, doing what is best for the common good. So far be it from me to try to provide intellectual ballast, you might say, to the administrative state. On the other hand, I live in the real world, and I recognize that the post-Road debates were live debates during Congress back in the 1790s, back in 1790, 1791. And as a purely pragmatic level, I mean, if you're going to have an attorney general, you're going to have a secretary of state, well, they're probably going to need some staffers, right? So, I mean, look, I at a certain level, I mean, we're not going to just literally eliminate this thing tomorrow. My general approach to the administrative state is more of a walk and chew gum at the same time mentality, which is where I simultaneously would agree with the efforts of originalists and constitutionalists to trim the sails and pare it back. We have a good chance to do so later this term in the herring fisherman case, the Chevron deference case, another case, by the way, where Vermeule and I probably disagree. But on the other hand, this is going to be a slower process, and we have to try to kind of wield the levers of power that are available to us in the meantime, which is one of the reasons why, to give them a shout out, I'm proud to be on the board of advisors for American Moments, which is kind of a young scrappy organization in Washington, D.C. that's really dedicated to trying to do exactly that, trying to train the next administration or the next generation's crop, you might say, of young, scrappy, and hungry a conservative or right of center bureaucrats and statesmen in the making.
So, well said. I think I share your perspective, Josh, that it makes zero sense to, fight with one hand tied behind your back if instead of when you have the reins of power, you can't wield it to redound towards conservative ends. You're in a sense dealing with a one-way ratchet, even if indeed you can have a profoundly different North Star for the direction of where you'd like to, take overall issues of the growth of the administrative state. Now, in closing, I wanted to point our listeners toward the conclusion of your remarks at the Common Good Constitutionalism Conference, which also the conclusion of your HJLPP piece where I'm quoting from. Quote, common good constitutionalism and common good originalism also share a common adversary, avowed legal positivism. As the right's anti-positivist or at minimum, and perhaps more accurately, positivist skeptical, march through the institutions hopefully accelerates, I'm optimistic that common good constitutionalism and common good originalism can coexist as very strong allies against this mutually shared sclerotic foe. Now, your conclusion shared much with what I said in an interview with Ian Ward for that very same Politico piece, and which actually ironically became the conclusion of his piece. This is what I said to him. I said, the chief foe of our time is legal positivism. We are in firm agreement. This is we as in Hadley and I with Vermeule. The received wisdom of what we would consider to be mainstream originalism, an originalism that prides itself on the careful avoidance of moral questions, positivism, restraint, that wasn't the Francis Fukuyama end of history. We're not content with saying, aha, it's been found out now, and the next phase will be debating the most narrow of issues. To our friends in conservative jurisprudence who think that Bostock was a one-off, who think Dobbs has foreclosed any kind of debate on this, I offer them Justice Scalia's words in Lawrence versus Texas, do not believe it. What gives you optimism that both of us are right, that indeed on the horizon for a restoration of a more morally coherent jurisprudence, there are positive signs?
I think the positive signs are, one, the fact that folks like us are still getting asked to talk about it, and the fact that the Dobbs decision did not entirely prematurely end, foreclose this debate, which it definitely had potential to do, no doubt about that. And more generally speaking, Garrett, like when I talk to law students, increasingly, frankly, even college students, when I do college talks, they seem really interested. And, you know, I've had any number of conversations with federal judges. I'm not going to name names. I would never do that. But I've had any number of conversations over the years with federal judges who tell me that they love my work on common good originalism, too, that they essentially agree with it and that they would love the right case or controversy to put it into an opinion, to actually implement it or operationalize it. To me, that is probably what has to happen next. We have to have an actual common good originalist opinion, someone who actually employs the methodology, who is showing what this looks like. Not an easy thing to do, by the way, because you basically need a case of first impression. You need a charged issue, probably a constitutional issue, could be a statutory issue, though, that lends itself to this sort of analysis. That to me is the next step. And then from there, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll get some judge who says before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator, I am a common good originalist. I mean, probably not. I'm not trying to get too excited about that. But look, life is funny, so you never know.
Well, I'll drink to that. Josh Hammer, thank you so much for being with us. Where can our listeners keep up with your work?
Garrett, you're a longtime friend. Thank you, as always, for your gracious hospitality. X, where I'm Josh_Hammer. I am on Instagram, Josh B. Hammer. I write a weekly syndicated column that goes up in Newsweek, which is where I work, and then a host of other right-of-center publications. And then I host two shows, The Josh Hammer Show and America on Trial with Josh Hammer, which are both available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Well, I'm a subscriber to both, and indeed, well worth your time. Not just subscribing to one, subscribe to them both to get your fix. Thank you to Mark Mateo for his help on this podcast. And with that, we can't wait to see you next time, Josh. Thanks.
Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.